everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Lunatics Radio Hour podcast. I'm Abby Brinker, sitting here with Alan Kudan.
Hello.
And today we have, I hate to say it because we've said it before, but I think this is going to be our biggest series yet.
At least our biggest footed series.
Ah, very good.
Really? That was
I wasn't expecting
that. Was it. Some low hanging fruit right there.
Well, you the delivery was nice. It was smooth.
You're a very easy audience.
As you know, because you have clicked on the episode, we are kicking off a Bigfoot series. Will it be two episodes? Will it be three? Will it be four? Only time will tell.
Really? You think we're going to get more than two?
Well, we have Bigfoot stories.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize there's so much to say about Bigfoot.
There's a lot to say. And let me say this. When I started this research, I really didn't believe in Bigfoot at all. I really didn't.
Oh, geez.
I thought that it was sort of a silly cryptid.
Yep.
I have now drank the Kool-Aid, and I'm going to present to you over the course of the next several episodes, very well researched and outlined evidence and proof from firsthand encounters to physical evidence. Alan, you always say, where's the evidence? You don't believe in ghosts. You don't. Well, I'm going to give you the evidence today.
This is going to be a tough sell.
Okay.
Telling you right now, I think Bigfoot is dumb as hell.
Wow. You've just upset a lot of people.
I know.
I'm going to isolate that soundbite.
Okay.
Blast it out on social media.
I understand that might upset some people.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Can I say this?
Sure.
To give you a sense of the landscape here.
Yeah.
I put out yesterday and today polls.
I thought you were going to say Bigfoot traps.
No, I would never. I put out polls on Twitter and Instagram, and I simply asked, do you believe in Bigfoot, yes or no? I was floored. Both on Instagram and on Twitter, overwhelming majority said yes.
I think you got a strong reaction from a vocal minority.
Do you know a lot about Bigfoot legend, Bigfoot mythology?
No, everyone knows that one clip of like Bigfoot walking, and like Mythbusters took it apart. Like, oh, look at the gait; it's slightly different from here. It's a guy in a suit.
Well, we're gonna talk about that at length today.
I understand the Pacific Northwest is a large area.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's lots of species there that are not yet discovered. But most of those are insects, or if they're mammalian, they're very, very small. To have a giant alpha predator in the area that they still can't confirm its actual existence? No. I mean,
what if they don't want to be caught and they're highly intelligent? I'm going to temperature check with you at the end of this and see how you feel.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I'm coming in with an open mind.
Are you?
Yes.
It sounds
I showed up, right? You said be here at this time and I'm here. Uh-huh. So I'm here with an open mind.
Okay.
I've been swayed in the past.
Yep.
I thought Mothman was pretty darn stupid.
Uh-huh.
And then we did the episode and I was swayed. I was swayed. I'm granted there were some external factors that I was able to pull from my own experiences.
Yep.
But after a thorough understanding of Mothman, is Mothman a cryptid?
Yes.
Okay. So I don't know, because it's like it's a bit more supernatural.
Yes. It's a cryptid and it's so much more. But I think largely people think of it as
okay,
a cryptid.
But Bigfoot is is right up there with the Loch Ness Monster.
Yes.
For sure. Like accessibility of cryptids, right?
1,000%.
Okay. Well, Loch Ness Monster, I don't think is real.
Okay. Well, actually, there's been some new developments in that case. So we'll have to talk about that at some point, too.
Okay. Well, if
some new archaeological evidence, I should say, in the Loch Ness Monster case.
They found his Facebook page.
They have found prehistoric dinosaur bones in other freshwater lakes, which lead them to believe that there could be the existence, or at some point, the existence of those sorts of prehistoric fish type animals in freshwater lakes.
Listen, I went on a bikepacking trip this last weekend.
I like that term, bikepacking.
Yeah, well, off a bike trail, nowhere near water, we found a rock that was very smooth. Clearly it had been in water, yet we were nowhere near water.
Okay.
So things get places, you know?
Yep.
Doesn't mean the Loch Ness Monster is real.
Pebble and a whole huge skeletal remains are a little bit different, but okay.
I think the pebble that took down Goliath would beg to differ.
Wow. Okay. Well, why don't we cool off and get into some housekeeping? Because obviously this is going to be a contentious episode. On a totally unrelated note, I do want to mention that our latest short film, The Witching Hour, which you can watch on our YouTube channel, has actually gotten into a few film festivals. One was in Brooklyn last week, but later this summer, it's going to be in the Midwest Sci-Fi Short Film Festival sometime around mid to late August, which will have a virtual component. So you'll actually be able to stream the whole festival and see our film, but a ton of other films as well. So I'm going to share details when I get them, but we're really excited to be able to be part of that, you know, from afar and be able to participate in a festival.
You know, I got to say, I love these little festivals. I think they're so fun. It's such a good, there's like a really good community around these little festivals, especially when they're genre-based.
Absolutely. And I've found so much community in the horror sci-fi, like even just regular short film festivals too that have a horror component. It's been so fun to meet other filmmakers.
It's like it's very similar to when we were at Paracon. Just the community of people that are all about this sort of thing.
Yes, it is a very uplifting community of artists for sure. The other thing we wanted to announce is that we're coming out with a new YouTube series, which is going to be kind of a rendition of our Campfire Tales episodes on the podcast. But Alan, when he was bikepacking this weekend, got some very stunning fire footage, and we're excited to kind of bring that together visually.
Okay, well, let me, sure. If I may, take sure. The lead on this one. So this is something that we've been talking about doing for probably the better part of a decade. Ever since Netflix came out with its creme de la creme of fireplace videos, we were thinking, wow, what a market that we would love to tap. We can join them among the greats of fireplace videos. So we packed up all the camera stuff. We went out to the woods, we set up camp, you know, we filmed our fire. It was wonderful. But the only thing is, like, this was at a public campground. So, you know, there's lots of other people camping. So we couldn't do any sound recording. So we now have these long fireplace videos, and that some that range in quality, I'll admit.
But they're not fireplace, they're campfire.
Sure, these are outdoor fireplace videos. So the original series, Fireplace for Your Home, directed by the brilliant George Ford, really set the bar for what a fireplace video could be.
Sure. Very high, huh?
Very, very high. And to our knowledge, this... You know, he's lonely on top of the mountain. No one.
Well, there's that Darth Vader one, the Darth Vader one on YouTube, where he's like on the funeral pyre for like 8 hours.
Oh,
that one was kind of like a cult favorite for a while.
I don't know if I've seen this one.
Oh, do you want me to show you?
Okay, so thank you for sharing that. We just took a little peek. There's a lot of creative liberties taken in that. We're going for a much more purist approach. No, okay. This is a no-nonsense, photo-accurate fireplace video. You know, we've been putting these on for years. Every time we play board games, D&D, whatever, it's just a beautiful ambiance in the background. But here's the thing. We wanted to record sound. Get that, you know, that real pristine fire crackling. You know, you search out the perfect wood. You make so it has like a little bit of moisture to it, but it still burns well, but you get all the crackles and pops from the moisture, you know.
It's a delicate balance.
It is. However, where we were, there were other families, and there was one that had children, another that was playing music, so we could not do sound recording. So we decided either we could sound design these fully and, you know, recreate the atmosphere, but it strips away a layer of authenticity from the truly discerning viewer.
As our viewers are.
Right. You know, they deserve the best. Absolutely. So we wouldn't hoodwink them like that.
No.
So what we've decided to do is take the few episodes that we shot. We call them episodes because it's going to be season one. And we're going to, the sound component is going to be our Campfire Tales episodes.
Campfire Tales, season one.
That's right.
Season of the Witch.
That's right. Yes. The thing is, we've only done two campfire tales so far. So either we'll recut them to, you know, stretch them out, or maybe we just make some extras.
Yeah, so if you have a short story, we've actually have a few submissions already ready to go. So if you have a short story that doesn't necessarily fit on a theme, but you've been sitting on this story waiting to be able to submit it, send it to us at filmsaboutlunatics@gmail.com, and we would love to feature it on our YouTube channel, and then hopefully someday on the podcast as well.
There you go. Yeah, it's an exciting time. Now, this first season, is, you know, it's real rough around the edges. Season two is going to be much more polished. Hopefully we'll have funding by then. You know, firewood's not cheap.
I have two Bigfoot-related housekeeping items to round us out here.
Mm.
Bigfoot housekeeping item number one.
Yes.
We have new Bigfoot merch.
Oh, yeah.
In our merch store. So if you head to lunaticsproject.com and you click on merch and you scroll around all of our beautifully designed merch, you will come across our new Bigfoot collection of apparel. It was designed by our very talented and lovely friend, Olivia. So please follow her on Instagram at olive.inc. And yeah, check it out. There's tote bags, which I'm going to be getting a lot of use out of this summer, but there's t-shirts, sweatshirts, all kinds of Bigfoot designs up there for you. So take a look, and it's a wonderful way to show some support, but also show everybody around you that you're into weird things like Bigfoot. Really set the scene before you meet strangers, you know?
You know, I really feel like we're trailblazers here, being the first people to make Bigfoot merch.
Yeah, my brother-in-law wears a lot of brewery t-shirts, and so many of just his brewery t-shirts have Bigfoot on them, I've noticed. Bigfoot is an icon, and we're going to talk about why. But our merch is trailblazing, you know?
Have you ever referred to him as your brother-in-law?
No, I actually didn't know that I could until the other day. I was describing who he was to me, and someone was like,
"It's not illegal to say that."
Your brother-in-law. I was like, "My sister's husband." They were like, "Your brother-in-law." And then
we just call him Steve.
Steve, yeah. He told me, actually, I just told him this a few days ago, and he said he was describing his relationship
to Bigfoot,
to the family, and they were like, "Right, they're your in-laws." And he was like, "Oh, right." So we both missed the same memo. But anyway, the final piece of Bigfoot related housekeeping that I have is just that I realized putting together this research that so much of it is really visual, that there's a lot of pictures and videos and prints, all of these things that we're going to dive into.
Rock solid proof.
So for Patreon, we're going to put together a mini documentary, just kind of encompassing a lot of this history, but also showing the visuals of what we're talking about. So head over to lunaticsproject.com and click on Patreon to support us and to see that if you're interested. So I'm going to warn you all now, there is a very long list of sources for today. And similar to what I think we did in the Mummies episode, I'm going to just say them for this episode. I'm not going to recite them again every single time. And we will post them on lunaticsproject.com. So if anyone wants to really dive into some of these sources and watch the footage that we did or read some of the articles or books that we did, we'll make sure it's public for you there. But bear with me as I walk through our long list of sources right now.
And as a reminder, everything has been fact-checked by Snopes. Everything here is just as official as the Bible.
There you go. Sources for this series. An Animal Planet series called Finding Bigfoot. History.com article by Betty Little, How the Bigfoot Legend Began. An Oregon Encyclopedia article by Robert Wells, Bigfoot Legend. A Live Science article by Benjamin Radford, The Yeti, Asia's Abominable Snowman. National Geographic article, Hunt for the Abominable Snowman. A YouTube video, The Film That Made Bigfoot a Star, from creator OPB. A Citizen Times article by Ari Sen, Bigfoot Sighting in McDowell, Fur-Clad Tourist Claims Responsibility.
Wait, Bigfoot Sighting with Andy McDowell?
A blog by Gowan McGregor, Enkiduism. A Los Angeles Times article by Scott Martell, Ray Wallace, 84, Took Bigfoot Secret to Grave, Now His Kids Spill It. All Things Interesting article by Marco Margardoff, 8 Unnerving Bigfoot Sightings. A Huffington Post article by Lee Spiegel, Another Skunk Ape or Bigfoot Hoaxer Reels Its Ugly Head in Florida Swamp. A Hypnagoria.com article, Monkey Business on the Union Canal. the Bigfoot Evidence YouTube channel, the Bigfoot Classified podcast, specifically the Mount St. Helens episodes, a book titled Shropshire Folklore, A Sheaf of Gleanings, a research article by Kathy Moskowitz-Strain, The Hairy Man Pictographs, History.com video on YouTube, The Proof is Out There, remarkable footage of Bigfoot's footprint, historic newspapers, which we will cite as we go, Wikipedia, Reddit, the Brave Wilderness YouTube channel, and firsthand footage and photos from big hunters and researchers and friends who have submitted stories. And I just want to say a major thanks to both April Branker and Tessa McKnight for massive research help on this one. Truly takes a village. So thank you all so much for your help.
I have a clarifying question. Is this episode exclusively about Bigfoot, or are we also encompassing Yetis, abominable snowmen, the sort?
It's 80% focused on North America, 20% focused on similar beliefs globally.
Okay, so that's still fair game.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, I that was my clarifying question.
Great. Let's start off by defining exactly what Bigfoot Sasquatch is so that we can really picture it together.
Also, what's the difference between Bigfoot and Sasquatch?
All things that you will find out as you listen to the remainder of the episode.
Okay.
Okay.
Is that part at least going to be in part one?
Yes, if I can get through it, yes.
You're getting snippy.
Bigfoot, or Sasquatch, is a creature from North American folklore. It's described physically as a large ape-like creature that walks on two legs and is covered in usually dark fur. Typically, it's described as being between 6 and 15 feet tall, but most sightings come in around 8 or 9 feet. So humanoid, but much, much taller, everyone usually also remarks on how wide the shoulders are. And so this, of course, explains the footprints, which would be much larger than a human's would be. Typically, it's believed that Bigfoot legs are shorter than an average man, but with longer arms. Like the proportions.
Like an ape.
Right. Yep, exactly. They're thought of to have human intelligence, but they're typically very non-violent towards people, though they have been known to throw rocks at people or to hit trees to make sounds, and they emit this very primal, I guess is the word for it, screech or howl.
We saw this type of behavior in the movie Primal.
Primal Rage.
Primal Rage.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm sorry. I'm getting ahead to the...
You're getting away.
The pop culture
section.
Yeah, they're pretty violent in that, actually.
Yeah, but in real life, they really avoid being seen or interacting with humans.
Real life, huh?
Listen, you just wait, mister. You just wait.
Okay.
The main symptoms of a Bigfoot sighting include...
Psychosis.
So a lot of physical evidence that can be found, like footprints, obviously... Fur that can't be attributed to other known species, and sometimes thin trees or saplings being bent over in a way that couldn't be explained by other trees falling over or by known animal behavior of those regions. Encounters usually with large mammals standing upright. Most seem to show Bigfoot standing at or behind a tree line watching humans, right? So whenever you see Bigfoot footage or photos, typically... they're kind of blended into a tree line observing people. The complexity of Bigfoot is that there are many known hoaxes, but there are some sightings, very famous ones, that still remain unsolved.
Oh?
Quoting from Robert Walls, quote, a few physical anthropologists, such as Jeff Meldrum at Idaho State University, and Grover Krantz at Washington State University, have espoused the biological reality of Bigfoot based on their examination of the 1967 film footage of a purported Bigfoot taken in Northern California's Klamath Mountains, or on their morphological analysis of footprints, some of which exhibit dermal ridges, as those found in the 1980s by a U.S. Forest Service employee in the Blue Mountains of northeastern Oregon. Most scientists, however, remain skeptics and dismiss the phenomenon as the product of mistaken identification of known animals or elaborate hoaxes, with prints cleverly planted to deceive.
Oh, yeah, I'd say that's true.
So we're just setting the stage, right? There are very intelligent, very respected scientists and anthropologists out there that believe in the validity of the evidence that we're going to talk about today, and there's others that don't.
There's a lot of very respected people that believe in some batshit crazy things.
Yeah.
But
maybe you think they're batshit crazy because you are close-minded.
I know. I told you I'm open-minded.
Doesn't sound like it.
Well, touche. By the way, so the footage that you just cited,
we're going to spend lots of time.
That's like the Bigfoot footage that everyone's seen, yeah, right? One that the black and white.
It's not black and white, but yeah.
It's not black and white?
It's color.
I've seen it in black and white.
Okay.
I think they might have altered it slightly.
Yeah, sounds.
Through desaturation.
You saw the remix.
Actually, yeah, now that I'm thinking about it, it was like video art.
Okay.
But no, okay, it's color, really?
Yeah.
Is there no black and white footage of Bigfoot? What am I thinking of?
Loch Ness Monster?
The Loch Ness Monster. Do they know each other?
Okay. Before we get into the history, let's define the space we're playing in today. Quoting from Wikipedia.
It's a 13 by 13 cube.
Cryptozoology is a pseudoscience and subculture that searches for and studies unknown, legendary, or extinct animals whose present existence is disputed or unsubstantiated, particularly those popular in folklore, such as Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, Yeti, the Chupacabra, or the Jersey Devil. Cryptozoologists refer to these entities as cryptids, a term coined by the subculture. Because it does not follow the scientific method, cryptozoology is considered a pseudoscience by mainstream science. It is neither a branch of zoology nor of folklore studies. It was originally founded in the 1950s by zoologists Bernard Huevelmans and Ivan T. Sanderson. Okay, we're being very holistic here.
She's reaching across the aisle.
Tales of Bigfoot-type creatures don't only span North America's indigenous people, but similar tales exist globally. So this is one thing I'm just going to pause on here, because this happens all the time with folklore. But isn't it so fascinating that we're talking about thousands of years ago? We'll get into the evidence of it. But there is evidence that we will talk about that up to 2,000 years ago in North America, the indigenous people who lived here believed in Bigfoot. And there's evidence like that globally about the Yeti, about all kinds of different global versions of this bipedal ape-like creature. So I just think let's just throw that out into the room. Let's just let that be something that sets the tone for this.
It's out there.
Okay?
It's in the room.
It's very close-minded for us to think that just because we, you know, don't have an overwhelming amount of evidence that this can't ever have existed or that it doesn't exist in some small capacity today.
I mean, I've traveled quite a bit. I've been to all five boroughs of New York.
Oh boy.
And I have not once seen evidence of a large bipedal ape.
In the U.S., there have been Bigfoot sightings reported in every single state with the exception of Hawaii. And globally, there are similar legends about creatures similar to Bigfoot in every continent except for Antarctica.
What the hell is Bigfoot doing in Nebraska?
What do you mean? That's an ideal location for Bigfoot.
It's just a big plain, isn't it? There's not a lot of trees, are there?
I mean, there's Bigfoot.
Iowa. What's he doing in Iowa?
Maybe he's passing through.
As we do with Iowa.
No disrespect to any of our Iowa listeners out there.
Just imagine being that big and hairy and being in a swamp in Florida. That sounds awful.
That's the skunk ape. There's a whole other
sub-creature. What the hell is the skunk ape?
We're going to get to it. This is what I'm saying. You are at the tip of the iceberg right now. Everything, all of this realization is going to explode into existence around you. Your world will be rocked.
Can we pivot to the skunk ape for a second?
No.
Okay.
What do you want to know about the skunk ape?
Everything.
The thing that I will say about the skunk ape, just to wet your whistle, is that in the video footage that I have obtained, he walks around carrying snakes.
That's pretty cool.
Like water moccasins that he looks like he's
What's
hunted.
A water moccasin?
A water snake.
Oh.
Yeah.
So he hunts them and he carries them?
Yeah. Or in this very short clip, you can see that he's carrying like a snake.
Like a catch and release or
No, a dead snake.
A dead snake.
Yeah. It's pretty limply laying there.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So you've seen this.
And you will too. Okay. I'm going to pivot away from skunk apes for now because we're going to kind of work through this history chronologically.
We can table it, but we'll have to circle back.
We will absolutely circle back. All right. So we're going to immediately perhaps jump the shark here. And
great.
Because it's chronologically the sound. First thing to talk about.
Oh.
But it is kind of like the 401 class. Like, this is the advanced class.
The 401?
You know, like 101 is like basic, 401 is like advanced.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the highway.
Oh, no. Okay. So here we go. So bear with me. Everybody take a deep breath. It's kind of more about a spiritual side of the story. And it's history that's often missed. And I came to find out about this from a suggestion by our friend Jameson Ridenour, who's actually been featured on the podcast before. But on Twitter, he responded to my call for some Bigfoot sources, and he pointed me in the direction of a blog called Enkiduism and an online article from the Citizen Times. Let's start with the Citizen Times article, which tells the story of how a man named Gowan McGregor was visiting Minnesota and was mistaken for a Sasquatch while wearing a suit of animal skins in the woods in the winter. We're all visualizing this, right?
So he's a big guy.
Well, I don't know how big he is, but he's wearing a suit. He's sewn together dark animal pelts and completely covered his body, and he's walking around the woods.
Like a barbarian.
Sure.
Like a very cliche barbarian.
Right. So now you might be wondering why McGregor was walking around in literally a full body suit of animal skins, which is a very normal thing to wonder. And the reason is that he is practicing a ritual outlined in the earliest recorded story in human history, the Epic of Gilgamesh.
That's the earliest recorded story?
Right. So not the earliest writings, but the earliest recorded fiction story.
That's pretty cool.
Very cool. And in the earliest recorded story of human history, we have Bigfoot ties.
Wow.
I'm just, again, slowly opening up the scope of this for you. So not only is the Epic of Gilgamesh the oldest fiction story,
mm-hmm.
in addition to that, it's the second oldest religious text, second only to the pyramid texts.
As in just any text that was found in the pyramids? Or is there an official
No, the pyramid
thing?
Texts are like capital P, capital T. It's like a specific set of findings, yeah.
Like the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Exactly.
Wait, are the Dead Sea Scrolls pyramid texts?
I don't know. We could look into that. We could circle back to that. So needless to say, it's a very important work to understand ancient humanity. And I'm not going to go too deeply into the Epic of Gilgamesh itself because it would be a whole thing. There's tons of politics and complexities to early life in Mesopotamia, but it dates back to about 2100 BCE and tells the story of Gilgamesh, the king of Uruk. One of the major characters in this epic poem is Enkidu, a wild man. Enkidu is not only one of the oldest literary or mythological characters in general, but he is also the oldest depiction of a wild man. The mythology goes that he was created in response to the prayers to the people of Uruk, and he was meant to balance out Gilgamesh, who had strayed from the natural world. Here's a quote from Wikipedia. Quote, "The tales of Enkidu's servitude are narrated in five surviving Sumerian poems, developing from a slave of Gilgamesh into a close comrade by the last poem, which describes Enkidu as Gilgamesh's friend. In the epic, Enkidu is created as a rival to King Gilgamesh, who tyrannizes his people, but they become friends, and together slay the monster Humbaba and the Bull of Heaven. Because of this, Enkidu is punished and dies, representing the mighty hero who dies early. The deep tragic loss of Enkidu profoundly inspires in Gilgamesh a quest to escape death by obtaining godly immortality. Enkidu has virtually no existence outside the stories relating to Gilgamesh. To the extent of current knowledge, he was never a god to be worshipped and is absent from the list of deities in ancient Mesopotamia." End quote. Okay, so that's just the history. But now we're going to go back to Gowan McGregor, the man wandering around Minnesota in a suit made of animal pelts.
Okay.
So McGregor seems to somewhat disagree with the sentiment that Enkidu isn't meant to be worshipped, because he does indeed honor him in rituals, one of which is walking around the woods in animal skins. Doing this, he has claimed to not only scare other hikers, but that he's had visions of long-forgotten gods, and has had several Sasquatch present themselves to him.
That's pretty cool.
Yes. So you can visit blogspot.enkiduism.com for more ways to worship Enkidu and learn more about McGregor's way of thinking about this. But again, I thought it was really unique and fascinating, like as a take not only on Sasquatch, but also mythology in general. And I thought the origins of this wild man mythology is important because it's going to come back when we get to other cultures as well.
What year was this guy?
Current.
Current.
His blog is current.
He has a blog.
Yeah. So Enkiduism, blogspot.com or blogspot.enkiduism.com is a current blog. He, again, really believes that by honoring Enkidu in these ways, he's opened himself up to visions of Sasquatch, which is, again, this sort of thing that is coming up more recently with certain paranormal investigators and people who study this sort of thing, that there isn't just cryptozoologists or ghost hunters, that all of the stuff is really connected. And that Bigfoot doesn't necessarily need to be a physical Bigfoot presence. Like, what if Bigfoot is some sort of vision or sighting that you see in the woods versus like a physical creature? You know, there's all kinds of ways to think about this.
Okay, you got me there.
Yeah.
That seems a bit more plausible.
I want you to think about this the way we are thinking about Mothman, right?
Yeah.
That it's bigger in scope than it's not this thing that fits in a box.
Right. It's not a big hairy creature literally hiding in the woods.
Right.
It is possibly a manifestation of some form that appears to people under certain circumstances.
It could be.
But outside of those circumstances, it does not have a corporeal presence.
Could be, right.
That that seems more plausible.
Great, I've already got him hooked. I mean, listen, this is, I will
we're,
give credit
hang on,
where credit.
We're still talking about Bigfoot. I'm not saying I'm hooked.
Okay, but I will give credit where credit is due. And I just want to say that the Newkirks, and you probably have heard me talk about their series Hellier, they're the ones who have really started this way of thinking, or in me anyway, to say that all of these things can be kind of the same thing, or have it, you know, we think of them as very separate things, these, you know, X-File type topics, but they really could be different than we think. And if we start kind of having Bigfoot hunters and ghost hunters talk to each other, like what, and like mythologists and folklorists, like what could we really find out?
So if we just reallocated, I don't know, maybe 30-40% of our defense budget to cryptozoology,
mm-hmm.
we would probably get some results.
Well, unless the government is involved in covering it up, and we're going to get into that later. I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but...
You do.
There's some interesting things to think about. Okay.
The government is covering up Bigfoot. That's what you just said.
I think it's something we could start thinking about.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to jump ahead from the earliest...
Gilgamesh.
Poem, yes. The earliest story ever to 1904.
But we're still pre-social media now because we're not with a guy in the woods with a tumbler.
Right. In 1904, settlers in the Sixties River area reported wild men living in the area among them, which has been corroborated by miners from that region for decades since.
Wait, hang on. So you're just saying that like there was a sighting in 1906?
No, in 1904.
In 1904, there was a sighting that's famous. And since then, it has been corroborated multiple times.
In 1904, miners of this specific area claimed miners.
As in like whack, whack, whack miners or child miners?
No, as in adult miners who are mining for coal had reported that there was something like that living in the woods around them, that they had all of these run-ins, right?
Mm.
And for decades since, miners and people who lived in that area at this time have all like supported those claims. But in 1924, one of the most iconic and historic Bigfoot sightings in North America happened.
In what year?
1924.
This is the black and white one?
No.
This is color?
No, this is, there's no evidence here. These are sightings.
There's no evidence.
Yes. 1924, miners who were working in the Mount St. Helens area, which is in Washington State.
Back when child labor was allowed.
Reported being attacked by quote-unquote apes. The headline read, "Fight with big apes reported by miners." And below that, "Fabled beasts are said to have bombarded cabin. One of animals, said to appear like huge gorilla, is killed by party." Also in 1924, a logger named Al Osman claimed to have been kidnapped and held by a group of Sasquatch while logging in British Columbia. Quoting from an article by James B. Schumann from the Los Angeles Times in 1968. So this article came out after the fact. Quote, "It was the middle of the night and I was groggy with sleep," 75-year-old Al Osman recalls. "Something big and powerful grabbed my sleeping bag and me inside of it. The beast, or whatever it was, threw me over its shoulder like a sack of flour. I could feel it striding on two legs like a giant gorilla." Osman, a husky logger looking for gold in British Columbia in 1924, estimates that he was carried bodily across wild and rugged terrain for 3 hours. The article goes on to say that he was only able to escape after being held in this like bowl-shaped basin area for 6 days. And after one of the Sasquatch, like there was this whole debacle because one of the Sasquatch started eating his chewing tobacco and got really sick. And so from the chaos that sort of came out of that, he was able to escape.
Hmm.
Indigenous people from this area have reported similar creatures who would skirt around near their tribes for years and years. Quoting again from Robert Walls, quote, "Native Americans in Oregon have increasingly situated Bigfoot within traditional belief systems as being with deeply rooted cultural significance. Tribes in coastal Oregon related Bigfoot to ancient tales of quote-unquote wild men who lurked near villages and left immense tracks. Members of plateau tribes, such as those at the Warm Springs Reservation, identify Bigfoot as a, quote, stick Indian, a diverse category of potentially hostile beings who stole salmon or confused people by whistling, causing them to become lost. Sightings and stories continue on reservations today, representing a spiritual connection to the pre-contact past and the resilience of indigenous cultural heritage," end quote.
That's pretty cool.
Yes.
I like the stealing salmon part.
Yeah, a little trickster energy. Betty Little's History.com article points out something really fascinating. There is a distinct difference between the history of Bigfoot and the history of Sasquatch, though I think many people use those terms today interchangeably. At least the average Joe does, which I say that I am.
Mm.
So this is the answer to your big question.
Okay.
The definitive coining of the term Bigfoot came in 1958, which we'll talk about soon. However, Sasquatch can be traced back much farther. Sasquatch is connected to the wild man mythology, again, that keeps coming up, right?
Right.
From Enkidu to indigenous cultures. The word itself comes from southwestern British Columbia and Canada.
Sasquatch or Sasquatch?
Yeah.
Okay.
Forgive my pronunciation here on this one.
You are forgiven.
I'm not asking you for forgiveness for the record, but thank you.
You just asked me.
I'm asking the listeners.
Oh, screw you.
The Sistalis, First Nation people, use the word Sasquets.
Sasquets.
Wildman mythology dates back much farther than our 1958 use of the word Bigfoot. And again, just to call it back to how we started the episode, the earliest recorded wild man is from the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is, you know, the oldest fiction story we have.
Does Enkidu look, is he depicted to look like Bigfoot?
He's depicted to look like a wild human. Wild man mythology is usually like a single human who kind of does not conform with society and lives in nature, but isn't in a pack of people or a tribe, is just kind of a single person. There are numerous examples from medieval Europe. In fact, that is where the wild man myth really takes shape. A simple explanation. It's a man or figure that lives in the woods alone, often called man of the woods as well. and is often compared to the satyr of classical mythology or the Sylvanus of Roman mythology. Wild men are often shown in paintings as being covered in hair and were often used in art of this era in a similar way to the green man, if you've seen Hellier, you know. So quoting from Wikipedia, quote, "The medieval wild man concept also drew on lore about similar beings from the classical world, such as the Roman faun and Sylvanus, and perhaps even Heracles. Several folk traditions about the wild man correspond with ancient practices and beliefs. Notably, peasants in the Grisons tried to capture the wild man by getting him drunk and tying him up in hopes that he would give them his wisdom in exchange for freedom," end quote.
So I just Googled Sylvanus just to see what it is, because mm-hmm. I know the name because it's come up in D&D.
Oh, yeah.
And there's actually a whole entry for 5th edition Sylvanus.
Oh.
And it's basically the green man. Apparently they have like two different forms. They have the old father and the young strider.
Hmm.
So depending on how they want to appear, but they'll like always be, you know, with a tree helping, they'll be with the tree will grow, you know, always around nature.
Like if they just touch the tree.
Yeah, like poison ivy powers.
Cool.
You know?
Yeah.
But also their flesh can fuse with wood, like they can become the tree.
It's like the plot of the X-Files episode that we watched for this.
Disagree with that.
Okay, well, we can come back to that.
I think they had camouflage. Very good camouflage. They had bark-like appearances, but they were not made of that.
It's also kind of similar to, obviously, the theme of the second season of Hellier, but also, if anyone has seen Men, the Alex Garland film from this year that I have a lot of opinions about, but that really sounds like the green man trope.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. All these, like, I don't know, they sound like pretty, like, OP druids, you know? They just have the powers of nature.
Right.
And can either commune with animals or make animals really big or, you know, summon hordes of little squirrels or something. You know, just...
It's like how I can turn into a bear in D&D because I'm playing a druid.
That's right.
It's pretty rock and roll. And, of course, there are tons of examples of quote-unquote wild men who are not part of a medieval art tradition, meaning people who did live in nature or were othered from society by some other reason, you know? So it's just important to say it's not all like mythology, rock and roll. Sometimes the wild men people are talking about is because of prejudice and discrimination.
Sure.
What I think is perhaps my favorite piece of evidence.
For what? The existence of Bigfoot?
Correct.
Okay.
Is what's called the Hairy Man Pictographs.
Is this from Harry and the Hendersons?
No. East of Porterville, California, is the Tule River Indian Reservation. On this land is a rock painting which has been dated by archaeologists as somewhere between 700 and 2,000 years old. You with me, Alan?
So slightly younger than Jesus.
Correct. It's widely known as the Hairy Man Pictograph, which is on what is called Painted Rock.
Which is a painted rock?
Correct.
Okay.
The paintings are inside a rock shelter and in color. They use red, white, black, and yellow. So these paintings depict many animals and what appears to be a mother, father, and child Sasquatch, among, again, many other families of animals. The Hairy Man painting is also the largest of all the images. The Hairy Man has an important role in the creation story of this tribe, like their story about the creation of humanity.
Mm.
And in these images, he is depicted as crying, which is in line with their mythology.
Gorillas can't cry.
They're not gorillas. They're Sasquatch. And do you know that gorillas can't cry?
Definitively, yes.
The creation story involves each animal saying what aspects people should have. Like all of these animals are coming together to create a new species. And they're all saying, like, for example, fish would say, I want people to be able to swim like me, right?
Why?
Because they're generous and kind.
That's so unhuman of them.
Yeah. However, when it was Hairy Man's turn, he said he didn't want people to walk on two legs like he did. But Coyote didn't agree with this and challenged Hairy Man to a race. And so the winner would decide how people would walk.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Hairy Man thought that Coyote would cheat, which he was known to do.
Of course.
So instead of racing, he decided to kind of like hop out of the race and help the other animals to create humans instead. And they did this by drawing the shape of humans in the earth and then breathing life into them, like all of these animals breathing life into them and creating humans.
Typical creation story, shaping out of clay.
Exactly, like golems. However, the people, when they were created, actually ended up being afraid of Hairy Man, and they ran away, and that's why he's sad and crying in the drawing. But Alan, before you comment, I want you to right now Google Hairy Man pictograph and look at it from 2,000 years ago.
It's kind of bad.
You mean it's a bad drawing?
It's a bad drawing.
Okay, that's your personal opinion.
Why am I looking at this? You wanted an evaluation.
I want you to see so that your brain can take in the evidence. Why don't you describe it for people?
Okay, so it looks like there's three things. They look like
cave drawings.
Yeah, they look like cave drawings. They look like they look like the Big Muppet.
Sweetums,
yes.
From the Frog Prince.
Yeah, but he no horns. Very smooth head.
Sweetums doesn't have horns.
He doesn't have horns?
No.
They have little horns.
No.
Okay. Well, he looks like Sweetums. That's the big one. The medium sized one looks like the same thing, but wearing a Crusader helmet. And then the little one looks like a penguin.
A penguin. Okay. Well, it's a
penguin with an afro.
So, listen, make of it what you will, but it's clearly not a human, right?
It does not. It appears humanoid, while there's some very distinct differences.
The legs are much shorter.
Sure. It's mostly just like the stance of the big one. Like the mama and the... I mean, we're also arbitrarily gendering these.
Yeah.
Which, now that I think about it, could be completely incorrect. But regardless, if not for the weird arm positions, not weird arm positions, actually pretty accurate arm positions of like, it's like the thing popping out of the woods, holding up his arms, ready to scare you.
Yeah.
Because like you look over at like the other two, those appear to be almost like bad kid drawings. Proportions are completely weird. Or just, yeah, that's just how unskilled artists, if you will, draw things.
Sure.
But the one of the large creature, humanoid thing, doesn't appear that. There's a lot of little details put in that appear that they were like deliberate choices that give perspective.
Yeah, exactly. So, worth a Google.
It is. It's an interesting drawing.
We're going to move now to more modern history. One method that is used over and over again to prove the existence of Bigfoot is the discovery of massive footprints. Large footprints were found in a Northern California logging camp in 1958 along Bluff Creek, which this location will come into play in a moment. One thing about Bigfoot in all of this mythology, too, is that there are certain locations like Bluff Creek and Mount St. Helens that kind of just come up again and again. But anyway, 1958, Bluff Creek logger Ray L. Wallace started to report Bigfoot sightings. He also claimed to catch the noises of the creatures in audio recordings. Though it was not a surprise to many in the Bigfoot community, after Wallace's death, his kids came clean and admitted their father's reports had been a hoax.
Of course they were.
They explained that he was a jokester and was having fun with it, and he wasn't trying to do anything malicious.
Mm-hmm.
It was later discovered that Wallace had been the one to leave the tracks at the logging site. He had used a 16-inch carving of a human foot that he had gotten from a friend. And the whole thing started as a prank that Wallace was playing on another logger, like on a coworker, if you will.
This is the penguin incident all over again.
The penguin incident?
Yeah, I don't remember the specifics, but some guy for like decades was putting on these homemade cleats and stomping around a beach that was a penguin breeding ground. And he fooled scientists for literally decades because he would just do this intermittently enough that they thought that there was like some kind of like 8-foot emperor penguin walking around this beach. And he, like, the hoax went on forever. Like, they, you know, they set up all sorts of stuff to, yeah, to try to track down this penguin. And, like, he lived nearby, so he got to enjoy the show.
That's fun.
But, yeah, eventually he came clean, I guess, when he just got bored.
Yeah, that's funny. 8-foot emperor penguin. So the complexity with the Wallace hoax is that many people cite this as the first thing that really launched Bigfoot from local folklore to full-blown cryptid. And this is, again, in modern society, right? Because obviously Sasquatch-type creatures have had their moment throughout history.
Sure.
However, it was this story about huge footprints that ran in the Humboldt Times that first sparked the term Bigfoot, used to describe the massive footprints.
Makes sense. It's got big feet.
In 1958, an article appeared in the Sunday edition of the Humboldt Times. Journalist Andrew Genzoli was conveying the message from a reader who had written in to tell the publication about mysterious large footprints, aka Bigfoot, that had been discovered by loggers in Northern California. Genzoli immediately connected these claims in a lighthearted way to the legends of the Yeti in other parts of the world. Because of the success of this article and the overwhelming response from readers, Genzoli continued to write about these Bigfoot claims and rumors, which just sparked such a huge interest nationally. In modern times, Bigfoot prints still continue to be one of those important forms of evidence in the community. Cliff Berkman has one of the largest collections of molds of these prints in the world. Cliff is one of the hosts of popular Animal Planet show called Finding Bigfoot, which I watched a bit of in preparation of for this series.
Do tell. What'd you think?
I mean, it's kind of got one of those, like, you know, like Animal Planet show vibes.
Ancient Aliens?
Yeah, like it's a little bit like, it's very produced, as it has to be, right? And I get that. It's very produced. I didn't really connect that deeply with any of the hosts, but I only watched the first season. I think there's like 10 or 12 seasons, and eventually the Newkirks are on it. So I do think it probably finds its voice at some point.
It may find its voice, but do they find Bigfoot?
Well, they do have tons of like thermal imaging encounters and the auditory things happen. But there's, you know, I'm only talking about the first few episodes of season one that I watched. So I can't account for the whole series.
I'm unconvinced.
Let's talk about it, Alan. Let's talk about the Patterson and Gimlin footage.
What's that? Is that the black and white famous one?
It's the footage that is in color that you keep thinking is black and white.
Mm.
This is, I would say, hands down, the most famous Bigfoot sighting of all time. When you Google Bigfoot, an image from this recording is usually one of the first things that comes up.
I'm putting that to the test right now.
Okay.
Bigfoot. Images. The very first image is in black and white.
Show it to me. That's not black and white, and it is from this footage.
Right.
And that kind of arm swing, that's frame 352, which has become the iconic, like, way that we depict Bigfoot in pop culture.
How do I watch the video?
Go to videos.
Tabbing over to videos. There's a guy in a suit.
Okay, let's talk about it. The alleged Patterson and Gimlin sighting took place in Bluff Creek, California, Bluff Creek again, in 1967. Patterson and Gimlin had both worked in the rodeo prior to this sighting. While in the woods just south of Oregon, they claimed to have captured a Bigfoot walking along the riverbed using a 16-millimeter camera. This footage is some of the most highly contested in the community. Some staunchly believe, while others wholeheartedly think it's a hoax. It's yet to be proven either way. But before we decide for ourselves, we need a bit of context here.
Okay, I'm ready.
So, in 2005, Bob Hieronymus went on TV, connected to a lie detector machine, and claimed that he was the one who wore the suit and pretended to be Bigfoot in the Patterson-Gimlin film.
Bam, done.
He passed the test. But despite that, this confession seemed to do very little to convince believers that the recording wasn't real. Jeff Meldrum is a professor at Idaho State University who teaches anthropology and anatomy. He is a hardcore believer in the footage, and he has dedicated much of his time to the study of Bigfoot. Jeff, along with his students, has studied the anatomy of the creature in the footage at length.
Okay.
For example, he says that you can see the shoulder blades moving beneath the skin and other muscle groups engaging in the back, the arms, and the legs that wouldn't exist in a simple ape suit.
Why would they lie?
For fame, for glory, for their moment, their 15 minutes of fame.
No, no, no. Why would he lie about wearing the suit?
For fame, for glory, for his 15 minutes. It's the most famous Bigfoot footage of all time. You don't think someone might... I mean, listen, I'm not defending it either way. I'm just telling you why I think someone might lie in that position.
To be like, listen, I know we just discovered this amazing thing, but instead I'm going to say it was me in a suit.
He came forward like 45 or 50 years later.
Yeah, they had their fun.
On the other end of the spectrum, there's a video of a costume manufacturer named Philip Morris claiming that
he... Philip Morris?
Yeah. I don't know. I couldn't quite find out. But claiming that he sold the alleged ape suit to Patterson. So, okay. Another notch against, right?
Yep.
Patterson and Gimlin also collected molds of the footprints that, you know, allegedly the Bigfoot created on film. These prints are not like most of the others. They showed dragging and push-off points. And they have been both studied and endorsed by Professor Jeff Meldrum.
Professor Jeff Meldrum?
Yes. You are such a little stinker.
This is Bigfoot we're talking about.
You said the same thing about Mothman.
And I was swayed. This, on the other hand, all this evidence is presented of like, hey, we faked it. We're admitting we faked it because you know what? Yeah, we want our moment to be like, you get that extra bump of recognition for like, and here's how we did it, you know? Because they waited decades, right? It wasn't during its heyday where somebody was being overshadowed and just like, you know what? Fuck you guys. I faked it. Here's me, right? No, they waited decades and then revealed all these fake things.
Well, the guys themselves never did, but other people came forward. Well, okay, here, let me give you some of the reasons why I am skeptical.
Okay.
So Patterson was very, and he was kind of like the ringleader of the duo. Mm-hmm. He was very much a Bigfoot hunter before the footage was captured, which I think is important to know. It wasn't like these guys were out fishing in the woods and they happened upon something.
Right.
They were people that were already very interested in this, which I think we have to take into account.
Right. All the more reason to fabricate something.
Exactly. And Patterson actually published a book about Bigfoot the year before this footage was released. Oh,
well, there you go.
I know.
That's it. And how many extra copies did he sell because he had his little Bigfoot footage?
I agree. The other thing to know is that he profited big time from this footage. He became a celebrity within the community, and he took the footage on tour throughout the U.S. and charged admission. Okay?
What year is this?
1967.
Before people can very easily have their own copies of footage.
Regardless of whether or not you believe, one thing is clear, though. This footage changed Bigfoot culture forever.
Okay.
Okay. Before this pivotal sighting, Bigfoot was just a local legend, a regional cryptid. After the Patterson-Gimlin film, the creature became a major icon that literally everybody has heard of. Okay, not literally everybody, but most everybody. Next, we're going to talk about the Paul Freeman footage, which I think maybe you'll have. I don't know. Maybe you won't. But Paul Freeman is a Bigfoot hunter who reported to have found tracks in 1994 with dermal ridges. So we're jumping ahead to the 90s here. What's more, he has footage, which you can find on YouTube, showing his discovery, which was located in the Blue Mountains. Again, this evidence has been deemed very interesting by Professor Jeff Meldrum.
The Professor Jeff Meldrum?
The footage shows Freeman walking around in the wilderness, scanning the camera from one oversized print to the other. He also shows the casts that he's making from the prints on camera.
And then it pans over to him making the prints.
No, like he's molding. He's molding them. So on camera, he measures the distance between each print, which is about 32 inches. And you can see from the footage that the area is filled with prints. Like you can kind of, you know, it's very clear. He also discovers on camera tracks that lead up and down this sort of dirt hill that look like drag marks, But that's where things get very interesting. So then, while he's, you know, he's recording his footprints, he's recording the molds he's making, he pans up. Boom.
Bigfoot. There's Bigfoot. Yep. There's Bigfoot.
In the footage. And I wasn't expecting that. I thought it was just going to be footprints.
Okay.
And the creature is very calmly waiting at the top of this hill. And when Paul notices him, he sort of just walks away, the Bigfoot. And many believers point to the excitement in Paul's voice when he sees the creature, saying he's either the best actor ever or it's real. And Paul has like a very good reputation. He's like a wildlife guy. He's a hiker. He's a photographer. And he's not kind of like this showman swindler in the same way Patterson was. And so people put a lot more stock in the Paul Freeman footage.
You're saying he's the Bob Dawn of Bigfoot hunters.
There you go. Do you want to watch the video?
Sure. Well, before I do, you've seen this, right?
Yes.
Are you convinced?
I don't think a video could ever can be convincing totally because...
Not in the days since CGI was invented.
But even before that, it could be a man in suit. Like there's just, especially with Bigfoot stuff, it's so hard to see. But the interesting thing is that all of the comments are really like supportive, which obviously shouldn't sway what you think, but people on YouTube are very hypercritical and they really seem to take, everyone really seems to take to this video.
What am I Googling?
Paul Freeman footage. So now you've seen the Paul Freeman footage.
Sure have.
From 1994.
From 1994.
You're not convinced.
No. Okay, here's the thing.
Okay.
As someone who works around cameras quite a bit, you're squinting at me. You're actually glaring. You're glaring through squinted eyes.
Go continue. Continue.
When you're filming something, right, and you're hoping to just capture something, right? You don't know. It's not planned. You're just hoping, right? You're fishing, basically. If you happen to catch something on camera, there's usually some kind of, you know, exclamation, right?
He exclaims.
No, he's like, oh, there he goes.
He goes, oh my God, there he goes right now. And he freaks out. He starts like chasing after him.
He does not chase.
He runs up the hill after them.
So here's the thing. The thing walks off to the left.
Also, would you run after a 15-foot gorilla in the forest?
No, I wouldn't. But I wouldn't have the camera start gently panning over to the right, over up. Just keep searching around. It's like, oh wow, I saw one. Maybe let's go and see what's over here.
You're reenacting this very poorly.
I'm conveying what I took away from this.
I'm going to challenge all of the listeners to go watch this video themselves. It's called the Freeman footage on YouTube. It's like an 8-minute and something video.
Sure. But if something walks off to the left, uh-huh, where do you look for it? To the left. You follow it.
He has to get up the hill.
He does. This is after he was up the hill.
No.
He starts looking down at the trail to the right, sweeping the brush, just like, let's see if what else we see.
You don't know where he's repositioned himself. This is a useless argument.
I'm saying is I was not convinced. I was his candor while he was like making the prints.
Mm-hmm.
100%. This seemed very, very accurate. Like this seemed very authentic. Like what the way he was speaking to himself, the way that he was kind of the way he was filming things. Like it felt very authentic.
Yeah.
And then once Bigfoot shows up, he's like, oh, wow, Bigfoot.
That's not how he responds at all. He's like, holy cow. And he also proceeds with caution because who knows, you know, if it's a safe situation. I actually think this one is, of them all,
if you
convincing
have spent a good amount of time and, you know, mental energy chasing something that is known to be very elusive, especially when it comes to being around cameras, and then you catch it, don't you think that'd be kind of an adrenaline rush moment?
I think he has an adrenaline rush.
He is so just like, what's over here?
I disagree.
Okay. And you're entitled to that opinion.
Thank you.
Because this is America.
I think the thing about this video that's the most convincing, because again, anyone could wear a suit, is his reaction for me. His response is, and there's actually also earlier in the footage from when he realizes it, there's a moment like around somewhere in the three minute mark where you see a Bigfoot quite close, which you didn't notice it while we were watching it. And I didn't the first time either, watching him quite close, that he doesn't notice and you didn't notice either. Because what I do learn from this is that they do blend quite well, and they know if they stay still in a wooded area, it's very hard to make them out from the background.
I mean, in all fairness, you could point out that, hey, that's a Bigfoot, but we're watching a super low resolution video that's gone through 1,000 downloads and re-uploads to YouTube, right? It's a really, all 3 pixels of Bigfoot, you know, sure, maybe that is a dark spot. To have any kind of validity, we would need like a decent quality version of the video. And that's also like something that I always think of when we see like photographic evidence of some of the supernatural. How UFO sightings, Bigfoot sightings, all these things drop off like crazy once people start carrying HD cameras in their pockets at all times.
I don't think that that's going to be the case here.
Okay. I guess we'll have to figure that out in part two.
Yes. All right. I mean, I will admit that you can get into a pretty wild YouTube or Reddit rabbit hole if you look up footage of Bigfoot sightings and humanoid sightings and all these things. There's just like too many for us to talk about holistically. And if you want to talk about modern versions, Alan, they certainly exist. To me, they're not any more valid than these are, though. And these ones seem very iconic culturally throughout history. But you can certainly find HD versions on Reddit today. I've spent many hours in the past few weeks scouring them. But it's still the same thing. You can Photoshop something even easier today than you could back then.
Absolutely.
So I don't know that the timeline, I don't think that Bigfoot sightings have dissipated at all over the years. But
what I'm saying is that once your video evidence can't be just like hand waved away with like, well, it's kind of hard to see what's going on, it gets thrown out.
I'm gonna read a quote from National Geographic to send us out of part one. Quote, in 1969, the Board of County Commissioners of Skamania County, Oregon, introduced a bill stating that any person found to have slain a Bigfoot creature would be punishable by law by a fine of up to $10,000 or imprisoned for up to 5 years. The board did not, however, claim that such a creature definitely existed. In the United States, the Bigfoot lore kicked into high gear by the 70s and 80s. There was an increase in sightings, footprints, documentaries, and by 1987, Bigfoot even made an appearance in a Hollywood blockbuster, Harry and the Hendersons. So we're going to sort of leave you all here for this week at the height of Bigfoot mania.
I would like to say one thing.
Okay.
Just, we're going to look at this law from a slightly different perspective. We're in the height of Bigfoot mania, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that believe in Bigfoot, and they would like nothing more than to bring a Bigfoot corpse back to prove to the world of existence once and for all. Simultaneously, there is just as many people putting on Bigfoot suits to fool people. I guarantee you that this has ended in at least one accidental homicide that they have shot at someone who is just trying to give them a little scare or a fun story. Quite possible.
Could be. So we will leave you here, not only at the height of Bigfoot mania in history, but also at the height of tension between Alan and I. And we have a lot of really cool kind of Bigfoot interpretations we're going to get into. Next episode, we have some firsthand experiences we're going to share. We have obviously all of the film and pop culture references, but I'm most excited to talk about the global versions of Sasquatch and Bigfoot, which is just really fun. So lots more to come next episode. Hopefully you're all hanging in there with us and you're not too frustrated at the closed-mindedness being represented on this episode. And we'll talk to you next time.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening. If you'd like some bonus content, consider supporting us on Patreon to access our patron-exclusive podcast, Horror Movie Club.
Also, head to lunaticsproject.com to check out our spooky merch and apparel.
You can find us at Lunatics Project on Twitter and TikTok, and The Lunatics Project on Instagram and YouTube, where you'll find our short horror films, cemetery tours, and so much more.
And please rate and review. A little feedback goes a long way to help us grow and get more content out there.
Our cover art is by Pilar Kep, and musical bumpers are by Michaela Papa and Jordan Moser.